All right. Well, whenever we behave, we often do it in a number of different ways. Sometimes you behave in one way accidentally, and when you do some things, you tell people about yourself. And we've looked a little bit about this last week, about how Jesus acted in a particular way to show who he is. And again, he's doing that tonight. As we see tonight, Jesus is acting in a very deliberate way to show who he is. And we do the same thing. We act in very deliberate ways to show people who we are, to give people some indication about our character and our identity. We do things to show people who we are. And this, for me, particularly has played itself out in my life from the time I began trying to impress girls. So it started around year 7 when I realized that girls existed and they're worth impressing. And there was this one girl who was in my year at school, and I liked her for pretty much the entirety of high school. And I was always trying to figure out ways to impress her. And there was one week when I was sitting at school and I was eating noodles out of a plastic bowl. And on top of the plastic bowl, there was a lid. And then inside the lid, there was a little fold-out spoon and fork thing. And it would fold out, you'd open it up, and then the spoon would come out one side and the fork would come out the other side. So I was eating with that, and this girl saw it. And she was like, "Oh, that's interesting." I was like, "Yes, it is interesting. I call it my spoony-forky thing." And she was like, "Oh, a spoony-forky thing." And I was like, "Yes." And then, after that, every day I brought the spoony forky thing to school. And whenever she was around, I'd just pull it out and I'd just start playing with it. So she'd notice me and be like, "Oh, is that the spoony forky thing?" And I'd be like, "Yes, yes it is." And she would know that I was a guy who had an excellent grasp of extraordinary utensils. She would be like, "Wow, this guy knows how to spoon things and use his fork at the same time. That's amazing." It would tell her something about me and my preparedness. It would also tell her that I was prepared if ever she was to invite me on a date quickly to just go and eat some noodles and some soup. She would know that I was ready at the drop of a hat. I wanted to tell her that I was that kind of a guy. It didn't really work. She wasn't that interested in me. She never asked me out, and that I wasn't going to ask her out. I was just waiting for her to ask me out. And somehow the spoony forky thing didn't do the trick. When I got a bit older, I learned some better tricks. In 2009, there was a girl I was trying to impress. So I would regularly go running near her house just in case she happened to be outside. And she'd be like, "Wow, Tom is so fit and athletic." But she was never there. When I was trying to impress Em and trying to convince her how impressive I was, I would send her long emails or long Facebook messages. And I would write messages which were, you know, talking about my feelings and talking about theology and being funny and witty. And I wanted her to read them and go, "Wow, Tom is an interesting guy. He's a funny guy and he loves Jesus. He is somebody I need to pay attention to." And then when I babysat my nephew, and I just kind of slipped it into conversation. So she'd be like, "Wow, he's witty, theological, and great with kids. He should be my husband." That was the plan. And then when I actually saw her, we met up after messaging for a few weeks. I ignored her because I was terrified of her. But eventually it all worked out and we got married because my messages did the trick. I let her know who I was because of what I did. I conveyed my identity to her through my actions most of the time. Sometimes it didn't work out so well, but in general, that's what I did. And we all do that. We all try and show people our best selves. We all try and do things to convince people of who we are. What Jesus is doing in this passage is he is showing the disciples exactly who he is. And they should have been paying attention in last week's story about Jesus feeding the 5,000, but the Bible tells us they didn't get it. And so now Jesus has to show them again. So we need to keep looking at the story. Jesus shows them himself, and it's not an accident. See, in the video we saw at the beginning, the guy starts walking on the water, and it's complete accident. He's looking at his phone. It's not an accident, you know, it's magic. Crazy magic. And he's walking, looking at his phone, he's like, "Oh my goodness, how did this happen?" Jesus is not like that. Jesus is very deliberate about what he's doing here. He's saying, "Look at what I do so you will know who I am." That's what Jesus is saying to the disciples. And it starts off, if we look at the passage, straight after the feeding of the 5,000. So if you remember from last week, the disciples, they were trying to get away. They were looking for somewhere to rest, to recover from their preaching tour. And they hadn't found the rest yet. So Jesus puts them in the boat and says, go off to Bethsaida and I will meet you there. So they head off on the boat, and then Jesus dismisses the crowd who are all full of fish and bread. They're all happy. And so he sends them away, and he goes up on the mountainside to pray. Because he also knows that just the disciples need time to rest and recuperate, he needs time to rest and recuperate. And he chooses to do that by talking to his Father. Then the Bible tells us that when he is there, he is out on the lake. Sorry, no, he's not out. The disciples are out on the lake, and he is up there on the mountain, and he looks out and he can see across the lake. As he looks across the lake, he can see the disciples are there straining against the oars. And this is, you know, one of the probably the first miracle in this story, the fact that he can see kilometers across a lake in the dark, in the middle of the night. He can see the disciples there straining against the oars. And then what the Bible says, it says that he goes, if we read it, have a look. It says in verse 48, it says, shortly before dawn, he went out to them walking on the lake. And then the Bible just keeps going. And what's great about the Bible, it is so understated. It's like, oh, he was walking on the lake. He wasn't walking on the lake. He was walking on the lake. It's amazing. You don't just walk on lakes. That's not how water works. I know this. I've been in water. I know that you can't walk on it. I am impressed if I can do anything more than doggy paddle when I'm in the water. So the fact that Jesus can be there walking on the lake, this is something worth shouting about. This is something worth talking about. This is not something where you just go, oh yeah, he was just walking on the lake. And people read this story and they see that Jesus is walking on the lake and they're like, ah, I don't know how comfortable I feel with this Jesus walking on the lake. Like, there must be some kind of explanation for this. I like Jesus. He says nice things. He does nice things. He's kind to the poor and all that kind of stuff. But I don't feel comfortable with him doing supernatural things. So they spend time trying to figure out some way to solve this problem. And they say, you know, maybe what was happening was there was this big wind and it uncovered some submerged stones. And Jesus was walking across stones on the lake to get out to the disciples, which is insane. Like, that doesn't work. Like, you don't sail your boat around this lake with submerged stones because that's going to ruin your boat. And then other people said, no. It wasn't that. There were these scientists at Florida State University who recently came up with this theory. Now, like once every 1,000 years, when the conditions are just right and the weather is right, during spring, there is a snap freeze on the lake. And so the lake would have been frozen in parts, and then Jesus would have just walked out across the ice to get to the disciples. As if, you know, Jesus just happened to be there on the one night in 1,000 years that the lake froze, which was the same day that he managed to feed 5,000 people, which was also the same day which he then ended up going across the other side and healing a bunch of people. That day was the day that the lake happened to freeze. And Jesus was like, oh, look, there's some ice. I might go walking on it. And then he walks across the lake. But that doesn't make sense either. Because, you know, the disciples probably would have run their boat into the ice, and actually there shouldn't have been, you know, if you go into the science of it, there needed to be calm conditions. And if we read in the passage, there was definitely not calm conditions. They've been rowing against the wind for hours and hours and hours. It was almost dawn by this stage. Other people said, well, you know, Mark was, he was over-spiritualizing something, and what really was happening there is Jesus wasn't actually walking on the lake. He was just walking by the lake. And then they made it spiritual. But that's a useless story. Who cares about that story? The disciples got in a boat and Jesus went on a mountainside to pray. And then he walked by the lake. The end. That's not a story worth putting in the Bible. Who cares if Jesus walked by a lake? We've all walked by a lake. The point of the story is that Jesus did a miracle. Jesus was walking on the water. That is what this is all about. Jesus was doing something insane. Our heads are not meant to grasp this. Jesus is doing something very specific to let the disciples know who he is. And that's why when the disciples see Jesus, they get terrified. It says in the Bible that he was about to pass them by, and then they scream, which is what you would do if you saw someone walking on the lake in the middle of the night. You would not go, oh, look, hey, it's Jesus. Hey, how you doing? You'd be like, hey, how you doing? That's not what would happen. You'd be like, oh my goodness, it's a demon. It's a demon. It's going to come and eat my soul. That's what you would freak out about. There's someone walking on the lake in the middle of the night. And so Jesus turns to them and says, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. And then we see this a strange bit in the passage that just before they screamed, that it says that Jesus was about to pass them by. Why would Jesus be about to pass them by? It doesn't make any sense. Like if Jesus started walking across the lake, it's like he was walking and then he forgot what he was doing. It's like, oh, I'll just keep walking then. And then the disciples saw him, they're like, oh, and it's like, oh, hey guys, how you doing? Some people have said maybe Jesus was trying to play a practical joke on the disciples. He was like, oh, I'll just run across the lake and then he'll surprise them at the other end. But that doesn't make a lot of sense. Like if you were Jesus, you just teleport there if you really wanted to play a good practical joke. Or other people say, oh no, you know, he was there, but he just wanted to, you know, could it sneak up on them and say good day and come around from the other side. Like Jesus, I mean, he's a good guy, but the Bible doesn't show him to be much of a prankster. So there's got to be some other explanation for why Jesus was about to pass them by. And it tells us that when Jesus gets into the boat, the disciples are completely amazed. The storm calms down, the wind stops, and they look at him and they're amazed because it says, they had not understood about the loaves, their hearts were hardened. And so what is it that they were meant to understand about the loaves? Well, if you think back to last week, you might remember that when Jesus fed the 5,000, he was letting people know that he was God himself, the God who provides for his people in the wilderness. Just as at the time of the Exodus, God provided for his people a bread in the wilderness, so Jesus does the same thing, but he provides abundantly. But the disciples, they haven't got it. They haven't understood it. Their hearts were hardened. And so the question is, you know, how was Jesus doing that? How was Jesus showing them who he was? Why was Jesus walking on the lake? And you might be saying, oh, yeah, I know why Jesus was walking on the lake. He was walking on the lake because he was God. That's what you'd say, of course. But you're saying that probably in your head because you know you've been conditioned by the story. The reason why Jesus can walk on the lake is because he is God. And we know that that's true. But just because he's walking on the lake doesn't necessarily mean he is God. He's just someone who can walk on the lake. You know, just because you can do something, it doesn't mean that you are something. For instance, I can yell out, stop, police. That doesn't mean I'm a policeman, but I can definitely yell out like a policeman. On the other hand, if a policeman wants to show you who they are, then they will show you their badge. And they show you their badge because they're a policeman, but they also show you a badge to show they are a policeman. It's about conveying their identity because of what they do. And Jesus isn't walking on the lake just because he is wanting to show who he is. Because of who he is, he's walking on the lake to show that who he is. Can you see the difference there? No, doesn't matter. We'll keep going. So we've got to look deeper into the Bible to understand exactly what's going on here. Now, there's a picture which I was meant to show you before, but I didn't, so there it is. Now, I just wanted to get ready for the next bit because we're going to look at the Bible. Now, there's this bit which we saw before where it says Jesus was about to pass them by. And this has a rich history in the Bible. If you're reading this and you were someone who, you know, lived in the Old Testament, and you remember there are important moments in the Bible where there is some passing by going on. In Exodus chapter 33, Moses has led the people out of Egypt and he's leading all of Israel. And as he's there, he's talking to God and he's saying to God, I need you to help me to lead these people. And so then in verse 18 of chapter 33, Moses says to God, now show me your glory. And God responds to Moses by saying, I will cause my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. But you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." And so the next morning, Moses goes up onto the mountain and he waits for God. And this is what it says in Exodus 34, in the next bit. It says, "Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, 'The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation.'" And what God is doing there is as he passes by Moses, he's showing him who he is. And he proclaims his name, and in his name is his identity, that he is Yahweh the Lord. He is Yahweh the Lord who is compassionate and gracious, who judges and forgives. This is who God is. He passes by Moses to show him his glory, to proclaim his name, to show who he is. And then again, later on in the Bible, we get into 1 Kings chapter 19, and we have the prophet Elijah. And Elijah has just had this fight with the prophets of Baal, which you may remember. It's one of the one where they put the cow on the altar and they douse it with water and then it all burns up. And it's a good story. You should look it up. But then Elijah, he gets really depressed. And so he wants to die, and God wants to revive his spirit. So he sends him off to a mountain. He sends him off to what scholars think is probably exactly the same mountain that Moses was on. And on that mountain, God speaks to him and says to him, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." And then it tells us that Elijah has an experience of God's glory and discovers who God is, and he's renewed by the presence of God there. God passes by to show his glory. And then we have this story with Jesus. And Jesus is up on a mountainside and he is praying. But instead of inviting the disciples to come up on the mountainside to him, he comes down to them. And he finds them in the midst of their chaotic rowing against the wind. He finds them in his trouble, in their trouble. And he passes by. He's about to pass by because he is showing them who he is. When God passes by, he shows his glory. Who passes by? It's God himself. Jesus is passing by to show them who he is. And then we hear this bit where the disciples scream and he turns to them and he says, "Take courage, it is I." And we saw in the passage before that God said his name was the Lord, which in Hebrew is Yahweh, Yahweh. Which if you remember back to what Yahweh means, it means I am. It's God saying, "I am who I am. I will be who I will be." And when Jesus says, "Take courage, it is I," the way that you can translate "it is I" from the Greek, you can also translate it to say, "I am." And so Jesus is about to pass them by, and then he turns to them when they are afraid and says, "Take courage, I am." He's showing them who he is, that he is God himself come to be with them in their troubles. God who makes a way across the waves towards them. God who sees them in their distress. God who shows them his glory as he rescues them from the storm. But the disciples, they don't understand because their hearts are hard. The question for us is, will we be the same types of people? Will our hearts be hard too? Will we miss who Jesus is? The other night, Em and I, we watched Undercover Boss. Who's watched Undercover Boss? A few of you have. Well, I watch this. I don't often watch the show. In fact, I've never watched the show before, but I knew that this sermon was coming up, and I was like, oh, this could be a good sermon illustration, and so I watched it, and funnily enough, here I am talking about it in the sermon. And Undercover Boss, the premise is that there is a CEO who gets found by the producers of the show, and the CEO will often run a large corporation, and the CEO gets dressed up and given terrible hair, and then, look, I'll show you, here's a CEO given terrible hair. Isn't that attractive? Anyway, the CEO is given terrible hair, and then they go and do some work in their company. It's normally like a service role where they have to deal with customers, and they work in the company, and they have to do the job of a grunt, the people on the ground. Then they discover what it's like for people who are at the lowest rung in their company. That's how Undercover Boss works. And then there's this bit at the end of the show where there's the great reveal, and they show the workers. They say, that guy with terrible hair is actually the CEO of your company. And I was really excited about this. I was hoping that in the show that there would be people who would be talking to the CEO, and they'd be like slagging off the CEO and like, I hate the boss of this company. They're useless. They don't do anything for us. They've got terrible hair. I hate them. I don't like them at all. And then there'd be the reveal, and they'd see the boss, and they'd be like, oh, no. And then the boss would be like, yes, you're fired. I thought that would be awesome, but no one got fired on the show. It was really disappointing. The boss was just really kind and, like, you know, paid someone $5,000 to stop swearing and gave someone else their college education and bought someone a new house to live in with their sick husband, which is very nice, but there was no firing. But I can imagine that at that point, when the boss gets revealed, that what would be going through their head, they'd be like, what did I say? Well, did I say the wrong thing? Did I do the wrong thing? How did I embarrass myself? How did I upset the boss? I'm going to get in trouble here. I imagine that's the kind of thing that would be going through their heads. And we watch the show and we see and we know who the boss is the whole time. We're like, we know who that is. We know exactly who the boss is the whole time. We're like, oh yeah, you're talking to the boss. It's so funny. It's hilarious. Now for the disciples, Jesus is revealing to them who he is in this passage. He's like, I am the undercover boss. Here I am. I have come to you. I am here with you in your troubles. But the disciples, they just don't get it. It's like if the undercover boss is like, I am the CEO. And the person's like, no, you're not. Like, yes, come with me on my private jet. Look at all my money. I'm wearing golden underpants. I am the CEO. And they're like, no, you're not. This is someone else's private jet. What's going on? Like, if they're not listening. They've hardened their hearts. And that's what the disciples do. They just haven't got it. But we can get it. Because we know the end of this story. We've heard the story before. We've seen that Jesus isn't just the one who walks across the water. He's not just the one who feeds 5,000 people. He's not just the one who heals dead girls and bleeding women. He's not just the one who calms storms. Jesus is also the one who came and died on a cross and rose again, defeating death. Only God can do that. We know exactly who Jesus is. We cannot harden our hearts to who he is. Because if we harden our hearts to who he is, we're not going to relate to him properly. Just like if people are talking to a boss and they don't understand that he is actually their boss, they're going to behave differently to if they understood that this person is their boss. If we relate to Jesus wrongly, then we're going to behave wrongly to Jesus. If we don't understand who Jesus is, if we harden our hearts to him. And you might be saying, okay, Tom, how does this happen? How do we harden our hearts against Jesus? And the way that this happens, I think, is that we understand that Jesus is God. And we're happy to say Jesus is God because he did all these miracles. He did amazing things. We're happy to say Jesus is God who forgives us for our sins. And Jesus is God who is kind and loving. We're happy to say that. This is Jesus. But we're not so happy with the Jesus who also demands that we follow him. Demands that we worship him, demands that we obey him. Because if we understand who Jesus is in our minds, then it has to change how we live through our hearts. We can't just have changed minds, we have to have changed hearts. And when we harden our hearts against Jesus, we don't live the way he wants us to. I suspect it's kind of like my relationship with the dentist. A few years ago, I lost a tooth in a terrible ice skating accident, and I can tell you about that later, but this is what I looked like. And it was excellent. I lost the tooth and I had to go to the dentist. And the dentist was like, "This is terrible. You look like you're from Queensland. We have to fix this." And I'm sorry, Queens. And the dentist was like, "All right, we're gonna give you a tooth." And I was like, "Oh, great." And so the dentist put in this fake tooth and he glued it to my other teeth. And it's like, "That's a temporary tooth." And I was like, "Great." And then a few weeks later, he's like, "All right, come in and we're going to give you a root canal on the other tooth, which has died. And then we're going to drill into your skull and put in a screw. And then we're going to screw in the implant tooth." And I was like, "This is fantastic. And it's all covered by insurance. Hooray." And so the dentist did all this and gave me a brand new tooth. And I'm like, "Thank you, dentist, for what you have done to my teeth. You have saved me from a low IQ. This is excellent." And then the dentist was like, "Okay, Tom, now we've fixed your teeth, I'm going to send you off to the hygienist." And so I went to the hygienist, and it turned out the hygienist was a very good-looking woman. And I, at that stage, was quite single at that point in time. And so I was like, "I'm happy to have a very good-looking woman stick her fingers in my mouth." I'm like, "Yeah, well, you know, that's some physical affection. Thank you, woman. That's very kind of you." And so she was, you know, working on my mouth. But then out came the pointy hooks and the proddy things. I just started sticking them into my jaw, my gums, and making me bleed everywhere and making me want to cry. I'm like, "Why are you doing this? You've got such a lovely face." And she would do this to me and then send me back off to the dentist. And then the dentist was like, "Ah, Tom, you need to fix your teeth. You need to floss every day and stop drinking sugary drinks. Otherwise, you won't be able to eat solid foods after the age of 60. Like, "No, be quiet. Stop telling me how to live. Stop trying to invade my mouth. This is my mouth, and I will choose how to treat my mouth, not you. It's not up to you to have a go at me and try and tell me how to live and poke around in my mouth and cause me pain. That is not your job. Your job is to save me from lost teeth, not to invade my mouth. Leave me alone, dentist." And so I broke up with my dentist and I never went back. And now I am happy because I'm sure my teeth are perfect and I don't want the dentist to tell me otherwise. And I think this is how often we can behave with Jesus. We'd be like, "Jesus, thank you so much for saving me. You are wonderful. I worship you. I love you. But don't tell me what to do with my life. You have no role there. You can be God of my salvation, but not of my day-to-day living. And I will come to you when I'm in trouble, but the rest of the time, I will leave you where you are." But if Jesus is God of your salvation, then he has to be God of everything else. He can't just save you. He needs to also change you. You need to allow him to do that. Otherwise, you are not treating him as God. That means that when you come here on a Sunday, it is great to sing to him. And it's great to worship him, but you also need to worship him when you leave here in the rest of your life. You can't come here and be in love with his kindness to you and then not go out and be kind to the people around you. You can't come to church on a Sunday and say, "You know, it's so wonderful, Jesus, what you've done for me," if it doesn't change how you behave when you go out with your friends on a Saturday night. You can't say, "I love Jesus that you love me," and then not love the poor who Jesus calls you to love. The fact that Jesus is God means that he can save you. But also, the fact that he is God means that he needs to change you. You need to let him work in you. People, when they look at your life, they should see a worshiper of Jesus. They should see that you are different, not just in the way that you think about your eternity, not just in the way that you think about your sin, but also in the way that you treat the people around you. People should see that you are a worshiper in your family, and that you are a worshiper at your school, and you are a worshiper of Jesus in your relationships, and in your marriage, and in your job, and in your uni. Wherever you are in life, people need to look at you and say, "This is someone who loves and worships Jesus." Jesus can't just save you. He also needs to change you. That is what it means for him to be God of your life. And you might be saying, "Tom, I think that we have gone a long way from Jesus coming to us in our storms. I want to keep thinking about Jesus walking across the water. I don't want to just be told that I need to behave." But the truth is, the fact that Jesus is God means that he can save us and that he has saved us in our greatest storm. And the Bible tells us that because of our sin, because of the way that we have rebelled against God, because of the way that we have hurt others, because of the relationships that we have broken, because that we have treated God like he doesn't exist and he doesn't matter, that we have got ourselves into our own mess, that we are people who are deserving of God's punishment, that this is the greatest storm that we could possibly face. And Jesus doesn't just leave us in our storm, but he has seen us in our trouble and he comes to us in our storms. And he saves us from it. And the way he does that is by taking all the punishment that we deserve on himself. And he stills the storm of God's wrath by taking God's wrath upon himself. All our sin, all our shame, all our brokenness, he takes for us. So that we get given new life. We are given forgiveness and life because he would die and rise again for us. And he does that because he is God. And so now, because he is God, we live for him. That we recognize who it is who has come to us. We recognize who it is who's caused his glory to pass us by. We recognize who it is who has said to us, "Take courage, I am." He is the one who has saved us, and he is the one who changes us. Because of his salvation, now we can be people who change. We don't change so he saves us, we change because he has saved us. That is what needs to change in us, that we treat him as God in all of our lives. We don't harden our hearts against him. We recognize who he is and we live differently because of it. If you are a Christian, then this means you need to think through, where in your life have you hardened your heart against Jesus? Where are you resisting him to change how you live? Where are you resisting the giving your life over to him in worship and loving him because of what he has done for you? You need to think this through and give it back to Jesus and say, "This, Jesus, I will give to you. You have saved me, now change me." And if you're someone who doesn't know Jesus and you haven't committed to Jesus, then you need to look at this and look at the evidence in the Bible and say, "Is it true that Jesus is God?" Because if it is true that Jesus is God, then he demands your love. He demands your worship. But he is also the one who will save you. No one else can and no one else will. Jesus loves you so much he died for you. And he gave his life and rose again to give you life. So if he is God, you need to give your life to him. All of us can recognize who Jesus is. All of us can give all of our lives to him. To keep seeking out those places where we have hardened our hearts towards him and say, "Jesus, this is my life and I give it to you." And though we stress and though we worry, we look to Jesus and we realize that even though this is hard, he says to us, "Take courage, I am." And he will be with us just as he was with the disciples, that he hopped in the boat and he traveled on with them. That Jesus comes to us, he lives with us, he travels with us too. And he is with us all the way, helping us to see him and love him as God himself. How about I pray for us? After I pray, just to give you a warning, I'm going to come on down the front here and we're going to do communion. So let's pray. Dear Jesus, we are so thankful that you are God. We thank you that you have shown us that we are not alone. That you have seen us in our distress, our great distress that we have brought upon ourselves, and you have saved us in it. I pray, Jesus, that we will not ignore who you are, that we will not harden our hearts against you, that we will not resist you, but we will let you be God in all of our lives, that you will be the God who saves us, and you will be the God who changes us. I pray now as we come to communion that you will help us, Jesus, to recognize what you have done for us and to dwell on that and to be moved by your love for us. And we think about how you as God gave your life for us.